This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll catch up on the legislative session at the Indiana State House with reporter Brandon Smith. A reminder, this show is not live. We're joined now by Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Before we dig into specific bills, can you give us a bit of a broad overview on how the session has been going so far and what lawmakers seem to be most focused on?
Sure. Well, importantly, this is a non-budget session, which means it's a short session. So the session only goes from the start of January through early to mid-March. And what that means, what it used to mean a long time ago, was that lawmakers would simply do fewer things. In fact, these off-year sessions, as they're sometimes referred to, weren't even a thing years and years and years ago. Then they were created as emergency sessions, only for emergencies. And eventually lawmakers started meeting every single year to do little things here and there. But lawmakers are trying to do a whole lot of big things this year. They just have less time than usual to do them because it's a short session. So, committee hearings are packed every single week. It's often called a sprint to the finish line. They've been working at a breakneck pace. So that's an important thing to remember about this particular legislative session. And in general, there are a few big topics that we'll talk about here and that lawmakers are focused on, things like vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine mandates, tax cuts, school curriculum, things like that, that I know you'll talk with Jeannie Lindsay about and things like that. So, they're not shying away from a lot of big controversial topics, despite the fact that I don't have a lot of time to do them.
Is that unusual for a session like this, or has this become the norm?
A little bit of both. It's not entirely unusual. I've been reporting here at the State House for over a decade now. This is my 12th session covering the General Assembly. They have never shied away from trying to take on a lot in a short session. It does feel this session, though, that they are tackling bigger and more controversial subjects than they sometimes do during a short session, in particular because the short session also coincides with it being an election year. And so a lot of times we've seen lawmakers kind of try and shy away from the more politically hot topics, if you will, because they know they have to face the voters in a few months. But clearly, and perhaps even because of that, in fact, they are not taking the same route this year.
Has there been anything that completely surprised you this session that might have been unexpected, come out of nowhere?
I think the pace at which particularly the House was working. Lawmakers, much like journalists, love to procrastinate. They will take their time as often as possible and work as close to their deadlines as possible a lot of times. The House certainly did not do that this year. They started off as fast as possible. They've been throwing a lot of these really big controversial measures right away. They are not wasting any time. So I think that's been a little bit unusual this session compared to all the other sessions that I've covered. Is there was no hanging around, taking their time on any of this. They are going right at it.
With us being 2 years into the pandemic now, are there some things that you've noticed with regards to how the pandemic has impacted lawmakers and the legislative session?
Not particularly this session. So last year, we saw several changes because of the pandemic. The House moved its entire chamber over to a different government building in order to accommodate greater social distancing. There was mask wearing a little more frequently last session. There were a lot of plastic barriers that were erected on the floors of the chambers. There were in committees. In the Senate, for instance, last session, they separated Senate lawmakers from the people who were testifying into two separate rooms so that the rooms weren't crowded and things like that. They limited the number of people in those rooms. All of that, every single COVID sort of safety protocol has been completely abandoned this year by the legislature. Mask wearing is a big one. Republicans generally do not wear masks. Democrats generally do. There are exceptions to both, but generally that's how we've seen it go this session. And I think one consequence of all of this is that, because certainly the pandemic is not over, COVID is still around. It's very much around. In fact, we're still in the middle of one of the worst surges of the entire pandemic right now because of the Omicron variant. We've seen a lot of lawmakers who are absent, and not enough that it's dramatically impacted business, but we are coming up to deadlines now when they have to pass bills out of their first chamber by a certain time. And if a bunch of lawmakers get sick, or more importantly, sometimes if staff gets sick, That's going to create a real problem. We didn't really have any outbreaks last year, to their credit, in part because of all those protocols I talked about. This year, all those protocols are gone. We haven't seen any huge outbreaks, or at least not noticeable, because they won't tell us if lawmakers are out, or how many lawmakers, how many staff have the virus. But it certainly has a greater chance of happening.
That's interesting that everything has been done away with COVID precautions. I know we'll talk a little bit more about some of the COVID mandate debates, but I am curious, there's no tracking system in place, like in some, I don't know, some schools and places. I know there's talk of getting rid of contact tracing in some instances, but with regards to state government, there's no tracking to see who's got COVID or who's been around who?
Not in the legislature in any formal way that we've seen. I mean, it's possible that legislative leadership are keeping track of staff and members who have the virus and have to be out or quarantining, but they certainly aren't telling anybody about it. So,
yeah. Well, I do want to get into some bills. You recently reported on a bill that involves small nuclear reactors. Can you tell us a bit more about this bill and what would it do if it passes?
Sure. That was a story written by our great environmental reporter, Rebecca Thiel, for Indiana Public Broadcasting. So it's this interesting idea of, Indiana has a state that historically has been incredibly reliant on coal for its energy production. It still is in a lot of ways, but that is starting to change. And so this is an effort to find another source. So there's been these sort of things that are shopped around, if you will, that are smaller, more advanced nuclear power plants. Indiana does not have a nuclear power plant, never has. But these would be smaller and more advanced than the sort of power plants we've seen elsewhere around the country. The problem is that they really aren't very well tested. So there's some in the nuclear, some scientists who believe that the smaller size is often used or sometimes used to justify cutting back on safety equipment and shrinking the area that would evacuate in a disaster. There's also a question of, we just don't know enough about these to start doing them. Now, if this bill becomes law, it's not like we're going to see one of these plants pop up tomorrow, because there's also still the question about how do we store nuclear waste, which is not really a question that we've answered in this country. So it has its, it certainly has its detractors who are worried about long-term impact and sort of the unanswered questions. But it also, you can see the appeal, which is that some believe this is safer and certainly better for the environment than traditional coal-fired plants. And it does provide a more reliable source of energy as we perhaps start to worry about that going into the future. But I'm not sure whether that bill will pass, because it's one of those where on both sides of the aisle, you'll have folks who like it and folks who don't.
Do energy bills in general, aren't they pretty complicated at the State House? I'm just thinking about, I know there's a lot with solar energy that we've talked about on this show before. It seems like there's a lot of hurdles.
There are, particularly for renewable energy, because quite frankly, utility companies have play a significant role at the State House in terms of their influence on the Republican supermajorities and the Republican-controlled legislature. Quite frankly, energy issues often are energy bills coming out of the State House are often passed over the objections of environmental advocates, climate change advocates, scientists, that sort of thing, at the behest of utility companies.
When it comes to anti-abortion bills that we've seen at the State House, is there anything that's come up this session that is different or more of the same?
A big difference in that we aren't seeing any major anti-abortion bills. I've covered, like I said, for 12 sessions, and I can count on less than one hand the number of sessions we've seen that they haven't done a major anti-abortion bill. But they are avoiding that. There's going to be one, maybe two, that will sort of deal with things at the fringes of abortion laws. Nothing really significant in those areas, and that's for a very specific reason. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected later this year to make a landmark ruling on abortion rights. A lot of people think they will eliminate or severely curtail abortion rights, the right to legal access to a safe abortion. lawmakers here think that's the case, too. But we don't know exactly what the court will say. They could go a few different routes. They could overturn Roe v. Wade, their landmark abortion rights ruling from 1973. They could overturn that entirely and say, you know, states can now basically ban all abortions. If that's the case, Indiana will do that. They could also, one of the lawsuits they're dealing with is out of the state of Mississippi, which restricted abortions until up until 15 weeks of pregnancy. That is the greatest restriction. The court has never allowed a restriction that tight before. So if they just said the Mississippi law is okay, Indiana lawmakers would immediately come in and pass a bill that would say, okay, after 15 weeks, abortions are banned. Anything they can do to restrict abortion, Indiana lawmakers will do. But because they don't know exactly what the Supreme Court will say, what they're going to do is they're going to wait. And they're going to say, okay, let's see what the court rules. And then if it is significant, they will ask the governor to call a special session of the General Assembly sometime probably this summer and come in and just do whatever anti-abortion bill they can get away with.
So they're just waiting to see how it plays out on the national level first.
Yeah, they and a lot of other people.
When it comes to cultural issues, how have those played a role in the session, this session?
I kind of alluded to this earlier. A lot of times we'll see on some of those issues, lawmakers want to avoid that in a short session because they've got elections coming up. But the reverse is actually true this year. We have heard that several House Republicans are worried about primaries. The redistricting and things like that have meant that there are very few general election races at the state house that are contentious anymore, or competitive, I should say. And so what lawmakers really have to worry about are primaries. And when you worry about a primary, you're worrying about it from the more extreme factions of your party, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. So if you're a Republican in the majority, you're worried about a challenge from somebody further right than you. And so they are tackling, I think, more wholeheartedly some of these cultural, you know, social hot button issues this year than usual, in part because what we've heard is some of them are worried about primary challenges and want to make sure that they have something on the record as soon as possible saying, well, I stood up for X, Y, or Z at the state house.
And we'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to All In. If you'd like to hear a podcast of this episode or any past episodes, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments and want to reach out to the show, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. And it's the Friday Recap, where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, we'll hear from two Notre Dame professors about their new book on living a happy and fulfilling life. We're speaking with Megan Sullivan and Paul Blaschko, Notre Dame professors and co-authors of the new book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. Megan, what was it like to put all of your work into a book that anyone can read now?
Oh my gosh. Well, Paul and I are next door neighbors and also co-teachers. So one of the tremendous reliefs after we signed the contract for this book was that I did not have to try to download my mind into a publicly accessible book. The process for writing this it's the first time I've ever done a big project like this with somebody else who's totally been involved at every stage. And I think this book really originated from conversations that Paul and I had nearly every day from 3 years as we were teaching the class and thinking, what are the big things that we're learning about philosophy as a result of what we're seeing every day in class? What are the questions where we know we disagree? What are the questions where we want to try to convince each other? And that process of having the conversation between the two of us from the very beginning, from like the first day we were working on the book, was transformative because it meant that, you know, a lot of being a professional philosopher, and Paul would say the same thing, a lot of it is having this really complex private inner life. And you do know a lot of these GRE vocabulary words and you know a lot of background theories. You probably have read way too much. And the art of really good philosophy, certainly the kind of philosophy you want to do with students and your friends, is conversation. And great conversations, you kind of hold back a little bit all of your geeky background knowledge and instead try to get quite to the point of the essence of the question. So I think that one of the things that was really fun and challenging about working on this book for me was it was the first project where from beginning to end, it's a recording of a conversation with another person that I care about.
That's really cool. And Paul, did you have any concerns ahead of time? Like maybe this book would be too insider for readers to appreciate?
I mean, certainly that's a challenge. Trying to explain to somebody why they should care about Descartes' Meditations. I think if you go about it in the wrong way, it's just a dead end. But I had seen enough excitement and enthusiasm from our students. And I had had enough conversations with them and also just, you know, seen them having conversations outside of our class. One of the big parts of our class here at Notre Dame is we have undergraduates lead small dialogue groups with their peers. And so just to see Notre Dame undergraduates get incredibly excited about, you know, this really sort of arcane philosophy sometimes and see them connect it to their everyday lives and then see that dialogue flourish, even apart from the enthusiasm that, you know, we're putting in class, that gave me sort of trust and faith that there was a way of connecting, there was a way of pitching this so that it would be relevant to a really broad audience. But of course, you know, making that sort of actually happen and making sure that you're hitting that, especially when you don't have kind of the types of cues that you have when you're teaching and the types of feedback. That was a big challenge. And I guess I didn't know going in how exactly that would work. I you know, found out the editors were a huge part of that process and massively helpful in giving us feedback and kind of saying, hey, here's how this strikes us. And that was just a really fruitful dynamic as well. But I mean, it's, you know, it's terrifying going in. But I think, you know, just seeing our student sort of reactions to the material gave me hope that this is an achievable goal.
One thing Paul and I also did very intentionally, we have really close relationships with the students that have taken God in the Good Life, and especially the students that come back to be like discussion leaders for the class. And some of them really worked with us on the book, especially in the middle phases. They read chapters and gave us feedback and engaged in philosophical debates. An area where a topic in philosophy that Paul and I just talk about all the time in our personal lives is the problem of evil. We're both religious folks. We're both Catholics. We have very different, like, you know, ways of engaging with our Catholic faith. And the problem of evil is this really famous, infamous philosophical problem of how can a good person believe in an omniscient, morally perfect being when there are just so many horrible things that happen in the world? Where is God when, fill in the blank, some awful thing happened? And there are different ways that philosophers try to understand why somebody would believe and worship God, even if there is so much suffering in the world. And you know, Paul and I definitely disagree about which of the philosophical moves is most comforting or seems most rational. And so in the book, you see this debate play out in our discussion about how we handle suffering in the good life and which different philosophers try to offer us different techniques for doing it. But one thing that was really exciting about the writing process was, I mean, Paul and I had had that conversation in little clips over the years, but then working on that chapter and with those students as interlocutors, we really got to lay out what really mattered to us on that question. And we'd been teaching on it for ages in a kind of detached way, but I think it never really gotten to the heart of our personal investment in understanding suffering and how it affected our lives so far. And I think, especially for those students who were working with us on that chapter, I don't think that they had seen professors wrestle with a philosophical question that's really existentially important to them, but also is the kind of thing that you could do research on Thomas Aquinas and Kierkegaard to start to solve. And so that was when I think that was the chapter where I think we really discovered the kind of magic for trying to include other people in these conversations.
Paul, you give some exercises in the book to get people thinking about their lives, and exercises involve contemplating philosophical questions. Is this a lost art that we could all benefit from getting back to?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I think, you know, we may have forgotten in our culture, and even in professional philosophy, is that philosophy originated in kind of a therapeutic mode. Like the Stoics, for instance, who were really early on in the history of philosophy, they were trying to answer the problem that we all face when we realize that a lot of things are outside of our control, and this causes great anxiety. And so, you know, the meditations that we find in Marcus Aurelius or Epictetus, they're really sort of practically focused step-by-step activities that you can do. And, you know, they obviously have theory behind them. You know, Marcus Aurelius refers to the interrelatedness of the cosmos and you know, the sort of home that we have in the cosmos. And so, I mean, that picture, that worldview, that's going to imply a lot of things. And maybe you have to think hard about that and kind of argue about, you know, whether that view makes sense. But at the end of the day, you know, reading the Stoics, you are just doing an activity. You are meditating in a philosophical mode. And I think, you know, we've seen in recent, you know, decades, people are starting to rediscover that in our culture and incorporate that into a lot of different modes of meditation, both like mindfulness meditation and other kind of therapeutic modes. But I think there is something distinctive about, you know, philosophical practices like this. And I think, you know, we can only benefit from the wisdom that those practices contain.
Is there anything societal that happened that caused us to sort of lose this art of philosophizing and not see it as something important?
I think I really came to understand where we were culturally and what we lost when the pandemic happened. So Paul and I were working on this book really actively in 2020. We were in heavy drafting mode. And when everything shut down in March, you know, it's hard even now to go back mentally to that time, but we had these really busy lives. I can remember my Google Calendar just had blue boxes everywhere, like a Tetris game, trying to pack it full of activities and meetings and classes and working on this project and writing time. And then we faced this period where everything was canceled. We were, you know, left to kind of retreat into our homes and with our families and try to find things to do besides just watching television. And also feeling like how much of our good lives were attached to just running from event to event or trying to accomplish like thing after thing and realizing like what's left that's really wonderful in our life when that starts to be threatened or taken away. And I, at least in my adult life, I'd never lived through an experience like that. And I remember we were reading Stoics at that point with some of our students. And these two big Stoic ideas, first, that like the best things in your life are things that are that you can control, and they involve your mind and your virtue and things that you you can spend time just reflecting on, regardless of what else is happening. That insight and the one Paul just mentioned, the interconnectedness of all things, like, you know, the experience of the pandemic and COVID helped us realize that, oh my gosh, something that happens on the other half of the globe can significantly affect how I live my life. And likewise, how the decisions I make can significantly affect my community in ways that sometimes I don't even perceive. Like pondering those two thoughts and turning to philosophy as a way of helping us manage and understand that collective experience, I found that really helpful. And I think it was a nice, I'd always struggled to teach the contemplative philosophers, and I've always liked more action-packed, goal-driven philosophy. But the knowing a bit of philosophy as we walked into that quiet period and scary period, that changed forever how I read those guys and what the kinds of skills that I want to cultivate in my life, like this ability to sit back and reflect and think and kind of pull back from the day to day. And I think our culture just until now has been feeding us just the life of action and the action packed vision of the good life.
Right. Right. And Paul, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you should be suspicious if like a philosopher offers you a grand narrative, but I'm now going to offer you a grand narrative. So be suspicious.
Trust me, I'm a philosopher.
I think, you know, I think part of it has to do with the way in which philosophy has been intertwined with a lot of traditions that have changed radically in, you know, our contemporary society. So a lot of the most practical, you know, modes of philosophizing, ways of thinking, have been tied up, you know, traditionally with religions, with Christianity or Islam, with Buddhism. And I think in our culture, you know, maybe in sort of the recent history of our culture, when we think about how to improve our lives, when we think about, you know, how to set big picture goals for our life, we often, you know, reach to what's near at hand, which are really helpful ways of thinking, or, you know, psychology, social sciences, et cetera. But I think kind of disentangling and bringing out the different threads in some of these traditions and seeing, you know, the ways in which philosophy and religion and culture are intertwined and the ways in which they connect to each other and the ways in which they're detachable. I think that's a really important element in recapturing what's so valuable about these traditions, these sort of historically important wisdom traditions.
When it comes to sort of religious traditions and debate and discussion, I definitely learned a lot from the book, just how, as a Muslim woman, philosophers like Plato and Aristotle had influence on Islam and some of the debates and discussion. It was really eye-opening for me. And it made me, again, as I mentioned earlier, realize how much more interconnected we are than we may think. And it also made me think that we've lost a lot of that. You know, there's just a lot of just following something without questioning it, without looking into it or trying to understand that. Is that something that you found in your work?
Paul and I have been talking a lot about this recently, just watching what's happening on college campuses and in our national debates. We're at this weird cultural moment where questions are typically just used as weapons, either at Thanksgiving dinner or in classrooms. When you say you're asking somebody questions, you're usually just trying to kind of get them on record to make a point, to have an argument with them. When questions have always been like one of the engines of philosophy, just being curious about things or wanting to show people ideas that you have that might answer some of these like really big, woolly, philosophical, why are we here questions. And you see that with Islam and Christianity and Aristotle. So Aristotle is kind of the patron pagan philosopher saint of Christianity. He's the major inspiration for St. Thomas Aquinas and a lot of how we think about what it is to have a soul and what will happen to us when we die and how to understand what God and who God is. That comes from Aquinas, but Aquinas got it by adapting Aristotelian philosophy to what he was learning about his Christian tradition. And he only learned about Aristotle from Islamic scholars who were like, hey, you know, you got to check this guy out. This is like the most fascinating metaphysics we've seen. And this might be really useful to you as you try to build up your understanding. That's obviously, you know, there was a lot of complicated political dynamics as well going on in that period of medieval history. But this spirit of, hey, like, let me show you this really interesting idea. Let me show you this hypothesis about maybe how God works. Let me share with you this idea I have about what might make our lives meaningful given that we're going to die. That spirit of kind of sharing and questioning and wondering is something that we desperately need to recover. And that's something where philosophy is really at its strongest.
Yeah. And speaking of the pandemic, I feel like, as you both mentioned earlier, just having that quiet time to think, it really allowed a lot of people to slow down and sort of reevaluate. And maybe they didn't realize they were philosophizing in some way.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm currently teaching a class about work and the good life right now. And I think this is one particular area in which people have been doing a lot of philosophy over the past couple of years. And you're seeing it come out in different ways. People are really radically reorganizing the way that work fits into their life and sometimes, you know, making really big changes. I definitely think recognizing that for what it is, like a philosophical question, can really help us make progress on otherwise, you know, seemingly intractable sorts of problems in our life.
Sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say, we have about 2 minutes before break.
There is a really popular wrong philosophical view that's quite prevalent right now, which is that you should measure the goodness of your job or any other activity you're involved in by how much good you're producing out in the world. Like, how efficient are you at pumping things out into the world? And one area where we also think philosophy can help, and this comes up particularly in the chapter on work, is starting to value like integrity again and understanding what it means to be somebody who's not constantly measuring your worth based on how much you're pushing out in your job or in your family, but instead on the reasons that are binding your decisions together. And that's another area where I think a lot of people might find philosophy really therapeutic right now.
How did you decide which philosophers to focus on in the book? We can talk for a few, like a minute on that, and then we can pick up after break.
Yeah. I mean, I can start if that's right. I think all of the philosophers that appear in this book have had a major influence on our thinking. And sometimes it's because our students have introduced them to us. A lot of the students who serve as peer dialogue leaders for the class will come to us and they'll say, hey, I'm really interested in James Baldwin and Sartre. Like, is there any way that we could do a class day on that? And so, you know, some of the philosophers that we end up talking about in the book have come through conversations with those students. But again, each of the philosophers that we talk about in the book, at least in my case, I feel like I've had a personal encounter with them, and reading their work has really just changed the way that I think about the world in some significant way.
We're speaking with Megan Sullivan and Paul Blaschko, Notre Dame professors and co-authors of the new book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. If you want to reach out to us, you can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're joined now by Mandy Pardue, nursing coordinator at Lawrence Township, as we talk about how schools in Indiana are being affected by the Omicron variant and how it's impacting students, teachers, and staff. Welcome to the program, Mandy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to talk first about what it is that a nursing coordinator does at schools, and if you can give us a little insight into that.
Sure. Well, here at Lawrence Township, I am in charge of our nursing services, and we are lucky enough to also partner with Community Health Network that provides RNs and LPNs and MAs in our schools. So I coordinate that team of healthcare professionals. And then along with that, I help with policies, procedures, and for the past 2 years have been really involved in our COVID response.
And what are the schools like in the township? Are they unique in regards to how they're structured or how the nursing programs are there?
I'm sorry, could you say that one more time?
What are the schools at Lawrence Township like?
Well, we have 21 schools here in Lawrence Township. We've got two high schools. We've got two middle schools. We have a career center that services our high school students. And we have 11 elementary schools and 4 early learning centers. So we've got everyone here in Lawrence Township.
And so do these schools all have their own dedicated nurses?
Yes, they do. We have a healthcare professional in every building. I'm so thankful for that. I know many school districts do not have a health professional in every building. And definitely during this, through the pandemic, I've been very thankful that we can say we do have somebody in our buildings at all times that can help with healthcare needs.
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty unique experience to have. I'm just thinking of my own kids in the schools they've been in and we're lucky if there is even a nurse. I do want to get more into this topic later in the segment, but I'm curious in general, how are things right now with the schools, and how much of an impact has the Omicron variant had?
Yeah, so we were taken a little bit by surprise. I did feel like January was going to be rough just because we were coming back from holidays and everyone gathers during the holidays. But I don't think we were expecting the Omicron variant to be this explosive. I do feel hopeful this week because I have seen a little bit of a decrease in our number of reported cases. But for the first 3 weeks of this semester, it's been an enormous jump in our cases. I really haven't seen anything like it in the pandemic.
If you're listening live right now and have any questions or comments on the topic, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That number again is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Mandy Pardue, nursing coordinator at Lawrence Township, about how schools in Indiana are being affected by the Omicron variant. Mandy, what would you say is the biggest challenge you're facing right now in your job?
I would say just the sheer amount of paperwork and phone calls and reporting. To manage contact tracing for a school district with 16,000 students, it's a pretty big job, and our nursing team and principals have really partnered together to try to help in that job. But when you're trying to navigate and kind of assess over the phone if a kid is well enough to be at school or too sick to be at school and maybe needs to get tested. That's a lot of work for one person to do in a school. And then the reporting, since we're in Marion County, I report all of our positive cases to Marion County Health Department. And then I also have to report them to the Indiana State Department of Health.
So it seems like there's a little bit added work, or maybe not a little bit, but a lot more added work than before the pandemic.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Yeah. I think I could be a contact tracer as a profession now. I feel like I've gotten pretty good at it. But yeah, COVID has definitely taken up a lot of my daily tasks. But I feel like it is so important because we know that having in-person school is the best for our students, and I'm just happy that I can help make that happen.
Are other nurses in this system facing the same thing where they're becoming contact tracers most of the time versus, I guess, dealing with other things that typically they deal with?
I would say all of our nurses are really great at prioritizing. And so obviously our students with chronic health issues and emergencies are always going to come first. This might mean that there's nurses working some extra hours outside of the normal work day. And that's very stressful, but I don't know too many nurses that aren't working extra hours right now.
Now, I know contact tracing is been around for a long time, but it's become more talked about now. You know, even if you've never heard about it before, now you probably have. Have there been any systems put in place to make it easier from when you started to now, or is it still pretty much something where you've got to go one by one and contact people?
Yeah, we've got a lot. We've learned a lot. And so I think I heard the superintendent from Beech Grove talk about seating charts, and we use those a lot for our contact tracing. So classrooms have seating charts, buses have seating charts. If you have an event, you should know who's at your event. So when there is a positive case that comes up, we can go back pretty easily and be like, this is where this student was or the staff member was, and here are the people they were in contact with. Our teachers have also been a great help in contact tracing because we can say, who was this person around for more than 15 minutes, like within a 6-foot radius? And they will also help us identify close contacts.
I've heard a lot about the seating charts as a method. I'm just, you know, I like to find other ways to look at things sometimes. So I'm wondering, you know, is it always accurate? Do kids ever switch their seats or not fill in the seating chart where they're supposed to be?
Oh, for sure. There's always some variance, but that's where we really rely on the adults in the classroom or the adults on the bus or things like that. It really has become this giant team effort to try to make sure whoever was a close contact and needs to quarantine at home, that we're sending the right people home. We don't want any kid to be at school, or we don't want any kid to miss school if they don't need to. So we really do pride ourselves in only sending the kids home that really need to be home.
So what are the policies around safety for students and staff in Lawrence Township? Is it if somebody tests positive and you were around them, you also have to go home? Or is it because I've heard of some places where if the students are vaccinated, even if they were next to somebody who was positive, they still can come back to school?
Yeah. So we're following guidance as it ever changes. And so currently, if you are a close contact in a classroom where everyone is masked, you do not have to go home. If you are a close contact at the lunch table or at an event where you might not be wearing masks, such as band or choir, then you would have to go home. But if it's in the classroom seated where everyone's wearing masks, you don't have to go home. So that's been very nice because we've got to keep a lot of kids at school.
That's got to be a relief to not have to like constantly in and out, having some of those policy changes. I mean, are those changes that you're following via like the CDC or local health departments, or are you able to put some of your own policies in place?
We really follow whatever Indiana, the Department of Health tells us to do. They have a biweekly webinar that I attend, and whatever guidance they're giving out, then I bring back to our COVID logistics team and we see how we can implement that guidance into our school district policies and to see if we're even going to implement that. I know our superintendent meets with other superintendents in Marion County to also kind of see what other schools are doing and making sure this is going to be good for our kids, and then we'll implement it. So really, we don't really make up a lot of our own guidance. We're taking what Indiana Department of Health and Marion County Health Department tells us, and then figuring out how it works within Lawrence Township.
Has there been pushback from families who don't want to follow any of the policies that are being implemented?
I mean, there's always pushback. And I think a lot of people are really just frustrated because they also want their kids in school. And so anytime you have to quarantine somebody and say, hey, you can't come to school, there's going to be some people that are upset. But all in all, I think they're very understanding. I think our families and students have done such a good job with our mask mandate. Even our preschool kids are wearing their masks really well. They're really trying because they also want to be in school.
What would you say you've learned over the last 2 years? And is it anything that has enabled you to change maybe some of the ways that you've been doing stuff for the schools?
That's a really good question. I've always known that teamwork is important, but I feel like during this pandemic, it has really shown that we do have to come together as a team, and we all have to help each other out to make sure the day-to-day processes happen. I know people are stepping up in different roles that they might not have been in, just to make sure daily tasks get done. So it's just really shown that teamwork is so very important. As far as nursing practice, I don't know if I've learned anything specific, but actually got to, you know, use contact tracing, and I love epidemiology. And so this has been fascinating for me, but also one of the most difficult time periods I've had in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems, especially in the school setting, it's very, very stressful to have to deal with all of the things that are going on, including these staffing shortages. And so I wonder how much have the staffing shortages had an effect on you and what you're doing and other nurses?
Sure. Yeah. So our staffing, like I said, is through Community Health Network. So we're following Community Health Network policies with when people need to be home and when they can be at work and what PPE they need to be wearing. So that's been helpful, getting guidance from a healthcare system, because they're living and working that every day as well. And so we have had to have subs, and we have had to get creative. And I've been in a lot of clinics working day to day, but we're just making sure that we at least have one healthcare professional in that building that can take care of kids every day. And we've been successful so far.
Do the nurses ever have to fill in as substitute teachers, as we've been hearing in some states where the governor was coming in to substitute?
Yeah, luckily we have not had to do that. Our nurses are staying in the clinic and doing that. I know they will step out into the hallway and help do some monitoring and things like that, but they have not been pulled in to substitute teach.
Are there conversations happening at Lawrence with you and maybe other medical professionals about how things are going and what might need to change?
I think we're always looking at what might need to change or what will change. I'm always trying to guess what the CDC is going to do next. I'm not very successful at predicting that. But as we near the end of this pandemic, please, I would hope we would really just start focusing on keeping sick students and staff home, and maybe not so much of the quarantining. That's my hope, that we will someday get to that point. And if you're sick, you stay home, you wear a mask, we encourage vaccinations. Those are the three things that I've been really trying to get everyone to understand as my three most important things that we're doing in this pandemic.
The thing that I find interesting about the messaging now, I mean, it's great that it's getting out there. You know, if you're sick, stay home. I'm just remembering when my kids were younger and the messaging was get to school, no matter how sick you are, we need you in those chairs so we get our funding. And now it's a little bit different. Do you think that causes confusion for folks?
I think it could cause some confusion, but honestly, I really do think we've had really good messaging throughout this whole pandemic. Our website is up to date with all of our policies and our procedures and our protocols for COVID. And we send out messages. We sent out a big message at the beginning of January that reminded everyone, hey, if you are sick, you need to stay home. If you're unsure, please call the nurse and she can help. So yeah, I don't think they've been too confused. I think, especially just during this 2 years, we've really focused on, hey, let's stay home if you're sick. And then if you get better or you test negative, you can come on back.
What are you hoping for in the coming weeks and months with regards to where things are headed? Are you hoping that this surge is over with? I mean, I'm sure we all hope that. who knows what's on the horizon?
Yeah, I can't wait for the day that we have, you know, under 10 cases reported a day. Back in the first year of the pandemic, we really didn't have a ton of positive cases. And so we didn't deal with this number. And this is, it's been a lot of work and a lot of people coming together to try to get everyone who can be at school at school. So I would love to have decreased cases. And honestly, I'd love for someday we just go back to how we treat the flu. And if you have a fever and you're sick, you stay home. And then when you're better, you get to come back. So hope, that's my hope and dream, is that someday we can get back to where we were when we dealt with other health issues and illnesses and viruses.
As we get ready to wrap up here, I'm curious, what keeps you motivated to keep going despite all of these obstacles and the heavy loads of work?
Yeah, you know what? I really love public health. I started my career as a nurse at Riley Children's Hospital on an organ transplant floor, and I loved every minute of that. But my passion is public health. I don't know anywhere else where you can be with your patients for 180 days a year. And that's what school nurses do. They get to be with and follow their students and really make a huge difference in their health care. And so what keeps me going is just, we're keeping schools open. And I feel like in Lawrence Township, we have done a great job at keeping education going. And I love that we get to see our kids every day.
And what have you heard so far from families whose kids get to come back to school after, you know, that the remote period? Are they happy that this is going through? Are some wanting to go back to remote?
I think people are ecstatic when they get to return to school. We do have a small virtual option where if somebody is really wanting virtual for a number of different reasons, they could choose that. But for the vast majority, all of our kids are back in person and they are excited to be at school.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Mandy. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yes, thank you.
Mandy Pardue is a nursing coordinator at Lawrence Township. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.